The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Catherine Colbert, and I'm thrilled to be here tonight to introduce Emily Bazelon, who's the author of Charged, the new movement to transform American prosecution and end mass incarceration. The book is a powerful critique of the criminal justice system and an examination of the potent role that prosecutors play in that system. And all of you here tonight understand that really well, because we as Philadelphians are keenly aware of the important role that prosecutors play. In 2015, Philadelphia had the highest incarceration rate of America's 10 largest cities, partly as a result of the policies of Lynn Abraham, who, as you remember, Mayor Rizzo had dubbed one tough cookie. And today, the election of Larry Krasner, we have a new, what I think our author tonight has called a new breed of prosecutor who set out to reduce the rate of incarceration and, of course, in reform both the bail system and the probation and parole system. My state representative from the Upper Northwest, Chris Rabb, is going to be here to talk with Emily. He's an avid advocate for criminal justice reform, and I'm sure they will have a really interesting conversation. Before I tell you a little bit more about Emily, though, I just want a couple housekeeping things. First of all, can you please turn off your cell phones or at least put them to vibrate? And remember that following their discussion, their conversation, we're going to come out to the audience, so please wait. If you have a question, raise your hand and wait for the microphone to come to you. So a little bit more about Emily Bazelon. She is a staff writer for the New York Times Magazine and the Truman Capote Fellow for Creative Writing and Law at Yale Law School. She's the best-selling author of another book with a very long subtitle called Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. She's also the co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest, which is a very popular weekly podcast, and now the host of a new podcast that she started called Charged, based on the name of this book, and which is tells stories from the criminal justice system. Before joining the Times Magazine, Emily was a writer and editor for 9 years at Slate, where she co-founded the women's section, which is called Double X. And the good news, and as many of you in this audience already know, Emily was raised here in Philadelphia. She's a graduate of Germantown Friends School, Yale College, and Yale Law School. And many of you have known her and her family, so thank you for joining us tonight. Please join me all in welcoming Emily Bazelon and State Representative Chris Rabb.
Hi, everybody.
Hello. Oh, my. A lot of familiar faces in the room. Well, thank you all for coming out. I'm thrilled to be interviewing you.
That is so kind of you, Chris. I really appreciate it.
Well, we have a lot in common, and this is a particularly unique moment for many different reasons. And I mean, look at this audience. A lot of people are very interested in what you have to say and what you've written, for good reason. I've thoroughly enjoyed your book.
Thank you.
So I gotta ask you, first things first, why did you write it?
So we were joking backstage that after you write a book, it's actually hard to like remember. Why, what was the idea behind this? So several years ago, I was working on a story for the New York Times about the three strikes law in California. Which at the time was, you know, really harsh life sentences, and the third offense and even the second offense could be fairly minor. And I was interviewing the Republican conservative district attorney at the time in Los Angeles, whose name is Steve Cooley, and he was a supporter of reforming the three strikes law, so I was asking him why. And he told me a story about a man named Gregory Taylor. So Gregory Taylor, this is back when in the 90s, when Steve was a new prosecutor, and Gregory Taylor was a homeless man who had unscrewed the screws on a screen door to a food pantry at a church to get inside because he was hungry and was looking for food. And his case file landed not on Steve Cooley's desk, but on the desk of the prosecutor next to Steve. And that prosecutor decided to charge that crime as a third strike. And so Gregory Taylor got a life sentence for this offense. And Cooley told me the story because he thought that was wrong. And he was explaining to me how it had convinced him as the DA to ease up on some three strikes crimes, and he was supporting statewide reform. But I heard that story and thought, like, wait a second. The fact that this man's file, this case landed on one prosecutor's desk rather than the other, determined the whole course of his life. And I had never really thought about that idea before. But I think once you see how much discretion and power prosecutors have, you start to see it everywhere if you're interested in criminal justice. So I kind of followed that thread from there. And that really kind of led me to this book, especially after some academics like Angela Davis at American University wrote a really good book about prosecutors. And then a couple other academics noticed that prosecutors, you could really quantify that the increase in the number of prosecutors, the percentage of the time they bring felony charges, and then the way they use mandatory minimum sentences have really driven mass incarceration. So once I had this kind of story, and then also like a body of academic work to draw on, that's the genesis of the book.
Well, this is a really interesting moment for me because I'm having to deal with a lot of the issues reading in your book. I'm on the Judiciary Committee, and you know, Pennsylvania is a crazy state in many ways. And you have the same sentence for second degree murder as you do first degree murder. So if you're in someone's car, a knucklehead you know from the neighborhood, and he gets out the car and does something awful, and he murders someone, he takes a plea deal, and you don't because you didn't do anything wrong.
Conspiracy murder, right.
You're there for life without parole. And so, and in Pennsylvania, we're releasing 517 juvenile lifers.
Yes, you have the most in the country.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it was recently, you know, deemed unconstitutional in the state Supreme Court. And so as a state lawmaker, I visit state prisons. It's our third largest expense. 90% of our state budget counts for human services, basic education, and locking people up in cages. It's 90% of your tax dollars are going to that, $34 billion. And so I'm meeting people, processing your book through the lens of the experiences I've had as a new state lawmaker is just, it's compelling, it's challenging, but also there's hope in the book. But I want to talk about the format. This is a narrative nonfiction. And I really like that.
I
admit it, I love it.
That's
no,
good.
But telling the stories through the lens of their experiences, but also interweaving data and context. How did you come up with that? What was the process for you in terms of the format of the book?
So I had the idea pretty early on of using two stories, a story of a kind of old school tough on crime prosecutor and showing what I see as prosecutorial overreach and abuse. And then I wanted to tell a story about the challenges of trying to do the job a different way. But I also wanted both stories to be about violent crimes that we define as violent, because that's a really important part of mass incarceration. More than half the people in the country who are in jail and prison are in for crimes we define as violent, and I feel like that's the next frontier in our conversation about reform. And so once I had these two stories, then I tried to weave in some of the law along the way. My editor would send back chapters and say, more spinach. But I wanted to make sure that it was like the spinach was in a smoothie that you wouldn't mind drinking.
Right.
You wouldn't really notice the spinach. And I care a lot about that part of the book because I want people to read the book who don't know about the law, who might legal stories are intimidating. They're complicated. It can often feel like a barrier. So I was hoping that the stories would make the book appeal to a bigger audience.
I think it absolutely will. And I understand it has achieved some kind of something of note.
Yeah, so I, thank you, that was a good prompt. So yeah, the book made the New York Times bestseller list today. So exciting, thank you. It's like, kind of like a fantasy, honestly.
So talk to me, when you mentioned, you know, violent crime, it's a misnomer in many ways, right? Because there's violent acts, and then there's the conviction, right? So help folks understand the distinction between those two things and why it matters.
Right. So, you know, obviously there are crimes of violence. There are murders and rapes and armed robberies. And then there's this group of crimes that vary from state to state, but in a lot of states are counted as violent crimes, even though they don't involve either any violence, in fact, any harm, or no serious harm. So I'm talking now about the story in my book is possession of a gun. In New York, that is if you have a loaded gun without a license, even if you have no criminal record, you didn't use the gun, that's a 3.5-year mandatory minimum sentence for the most serious charge. Then there are crimes like if you break and enter into an empty dwelling, you didn't think anyone was home, you didn't encounter anyone, but the theory is that's a violent crime because you could have encountered someone. And then there are things like snatching someone's purse or iPhone on the street where you may have really fairly minimal contact, violent crime. And assault, I think, is part of this. There's obviously are really serious assaults, but there also are fights that happen that we used to much more rarely charge as felonies, and now they get charged as violent felonies more often.
So on that last front, and how it connects to mandatory minimums, nationally, we're seeing a trend away from mandatory minimums on a bipartisan level. Not so much in Pennsylvania, and not just Republicans. What does that mean? I mean, what is that? How do we process the toll of tough on crime and the efficacy of mandatory minimums?
So mandatory minimums obviously, you know, are kind of zero tolerance. They treat everyone in the category as the same. And this country, they passed, I think in every state in the country, mandatory minimums passed in one form or another in the 80s and 90s. They were a response to a rise in crime starting in the late 70s, and also a response to politicians, you know, from Barry Goldwater and Richard Nixon on down, who were very successful at making people afraid and making them think that locking people up was the way to assuage their fears. So the part that I don't think we talked about at the time was that mandatory sentences take discretion from judges, but they don't eliminate it, right? The idea was that you're tying the hands of like a softy judge, but you can't take discretion out of the criminal justice system. It's like a toothpaste coming out of a tube. It's going to come out somewhere. And so it really shifted discretion to prosecutors, because with a mandatory sentence, the punishment is baked into the charge and the plea bargain. And the charge gives prosecutors much more leverage at plea bargaining. So that shift, while we were just thinking of it as like locking people up, we made prosecutors more powerful in a lot of cases than judges. And we really caused the trial to almost disappear from state courts.
Why is that? Tell me, in terms of the numbers, when we talk about plea deals, what are we talking about? What's the context?
So in a lot of state court systems, we're talking about 98% of convictions being obtained through plea bargains. So there's a big chunk of cases, like between 25 and 35%, that get dismissed along the way. If you're patient, your case may be dismissed. But if you're going to get convicted, the chances of a trial are incredibly low, and that's really because prosecutors can ramp up charges and make it too much of a risk for people to go to trial. And one way that you can see the power of that leverage is that of all the exonerations that we've had, 18% of them are people who pled guilty. So you can see in those cases, people who are afraid to roll the dice on their own innocence because of the high penalties they're facing.
Roll the dice on their own innocence. So why would they be impatient about about justice?
Well, if you're in a system and you are being assumed to be guilty and nobody believes you, And you know that you're innocent, but everyone around you is telling you to plead guilty and kind of treating you as disposable, which really happens a lot. You may think you really have no choice. So one story I tell for in one chapter in the book is about a man named Joe Buffy in West Virginia. He was accused of a terrible crime, this robbery and rape of a very elderly woman. He was from a family in this town in West Virginia that people didn't think well of. He was brought in for questioning. He'd been out that night and he'd actually stolen some Christmas gifts from the Salvation Army. So that's like kind of, you know, the police were suspicious. They kept him for questioning for many hours. They didn't give him any food. Finally, he said, okay, fine, I did it. Then they asked him, almost immediately said, wait, I take it back. They asked him all these questions about the way the crime was conducted. He couldn't answer any of them properly. And then his defense lawyer counseled him to plead guilty, take responsibility, there'll be a light sentence, the judge will, you're only 19. In fact, he got 30 years in prison for this crime. And then it turned out that all along, the prosecutors had DNA showing from the rape kit showing that he was not the perpetrator. But they tried to reconvict him despite that anyway, after he got representation.
So you heard the audible gasps.
Yeah, it's a horrifying story.
This is not an anomalous group, I think. Anyone who hears these types of stories, you're justifiably enraged. So why is this? Are prosecutors inherently bad people? Is that what you want us to get from the book?
No, because I don't want you to think that.
Okay, so, you know, I'm you know, this is tongue-in-cheek here, but I'm making a point. Why would anyone in their right mind, competent officers of the court, lawyers, sitting on information, they have a guy who they know didn't do it. What causes this type? It's systemic.
Yes. I mean, I do think this is an extreme example of stubbornness, to be fair. Look. Most prosecutors go into the job, they want to do better by the world, like most people in public service. They're not trying to do harm. But in a lot of prosecutors' offices, and I'm not speaking right now of the current Philadelphia District Attorney's Office, which is really trying to offer an alternative. I just want to make that clear. But in a lot of prosecutors' offices, the culture is one where you're rewarded for big convictions, for heavy sentences. And there's an assumption that everybody is guilty. That was something I heard from prosecutors in different offices around the country. I think in this particular case, you also see a refusal to admit that you made a mistake. It must be a terrible thing to imagine that you put an innocent person in prison, right? That's causing terrible harm. And so that particular prosecutor I interviewed a couple years ago was just insisting that Joe Buffy had to be the co-conspirator, even though the victim had only it didn't make sense factually, but he was really sticking to
that
story.
Confirmation bias, right? You
Absolutely.
Talk about that in the book. Why don't you give us a little taste of that in terms of how, as human beings, we get into scenarios that lead to really bad outcomes, even though that's not explicit or intentional, but that's how it works out.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really important thing to remember generally about professionals who make what seem to be bewildering mistakes or get close to the line of misconduct, that, you know, once you've accused someone of a crime and you've arrested them and charged them, there's a lot of incentive to read the evidence in a way that supports the decision that you made. Again, you don't want to think that you screwed up someone's life, that the real perpetrator is out there unapprehended. And so there is a pattern of tunnel vision in some prosecutors' offices where you can kind of see them move toward a conviction that turns out to be of an innocent person, and then in retrospectively, it seems like, well, there were these other signs pointing in other directions. But there is a very human tendency to see evidence in a way that confirms our previous bias. And once you've picked your suspect, you kind of have that bias.
So, and you kind of saw that talking to folks, right? And this was not just kind of academic. This was you engaging folks as you researched the book. What are lessons we can learn from that in terms of people being aware? It's like a lot of the conversation occurs now about implicit bias. And if you don't know what implicit bias is, you're going to continue to do it. Once you realize that we are all susceptible to these things, we have the ability to pivot. What are the things that you've learned from those folks who have processed it from that perspective?
Well, some prosecutors' offices that have realized they've had a pattern of wrongful convictions have gone back and tried to be more thoughtful about the original charging decision in a tricky case and to convene a panel of people. So you can do it, you can bring in outsiders, but even within the office, it's almost, they've described this to me as, okay, you know, we have this case, what are the holes, that the people around the table are acting like appellate judges, or in my case, editors, fact checkers, people trying to probe the case for weakness before you take all the steps that makes the engine rev up so that it's very hard to stop.
Right, and so almost like having a formal devil's advocate.
Exactly.
And you talk about it in the book as well. How many DA's offices employ those types of interventions, so to speak?
I mean, not that many. So to set the table in terms of numbers, there are more than 2,400 elected prosecutors around the country. So when we're talking about an effort to elect progressives as prosecutors or reform offices, we're talking about a small fraction of that whole. However, the people getting elected who are interested in reform and have been really committed are in big cities like Philadelphia, and so they have outsized influence. There's a law professor at the University of North Carolina who's been studying how we elect different prosecutors really closely, and she figured out that if progressive, reform-minded DAs were elected in the 125 biggest districts in the country, that would change criminal justice for half the population. Even though they're 2,400 people, a lot of people are from very small rural areas. So I don't mean to, throw the small rural areas under the bus. But I think it shows how this effort to elect a new kind of DA can really make change for a lot of people and provide a model for states.
So just taking a step back, if we compare ourselves to other industrialized nations, our counterparts, they don't have elected
No, nobody does it this way, which usually is like means that something's not quite right. When we're the
like the Electoral
people,
College, maybe.
Like the Electoral College, or like for-profit bail turns out to be the United States and the Philippines. It's illegal in the whole rest of the world. Like people are
so
like, that, well,
that's our distinction, us and the Philippines.
Yes. But I have become really agnostic about electing prosecutors. I think prosecutors are different from judges. Like, electing judges seems to me like a terrible idea, partly because when I was started voting in Philadelphia, there would be this long slate of names. I never knew who anyone was, even though, like, my dad was a lawyer who knew a lot of things. It was just confusing. It didn't feel like a satisfied, informed vote. But you have one DA, and he or she is more like the mayor. However, that's only true if people are really paying attention. And when the ACLU did a survey a couple years ago, only half of Americans surveyed knew that they had the power to elect their local prosecutor. So that seems like, I actually feel like if all my book accomplishes is that number goes up and more people are aware
right.
of that power, that would be a good way to declare victory.
Well, that's interesting. Because I'm a ward leader, so all I'm dealing now with is phone calls from judicial candidates. And one of the things I've asked them is, I've taken upon myself to video them so that the public knows who they are, what they look like, what the names are. And I said, tell me your name, the position you're running for, what the position is, and why you're running. And a couple of them are like, what the position is? Like, I'm like, yes, because people don't know the job you want. They don't know if they're not in the criminal justice system, if they're not an attorney. How are they going to know what the Court of Common Pleas is or the municipal court? How are they going to know these distinctions? Here's an opportunity to talk directly to voters. And they're like, really? I'm like, yeah, really. So
and they're not so excited about that. There's also
some are and some aren't, but it's new because normally
they just. Right.
I mean, how many folks are super voters who vote all the time? Raise your hands. You vote.
Oh my
Look
God.
At this crowd, right?
This is a crowd.
But you know, I'm not going to ask you to keep your hand up if you know the backstory of every judicial candidate and what they do. No. And so what I have is a lot of kind of collective angst and. Guilt about, like, gosh, you know, I have a college degree, but I know nothing about this process, who's running and all this, and I feel bad, but it's not the fault of the electorate.
Right.
It's society at large has to make sure that we have the type of civic education to make this important. And why Larry Krasner's election was so powerful, it was a grassroots movement. Irrespective of whether you voted for him, you like him or anything, you can't say there wasn't a groundswell that involved a wide range of stakeholders who said this is important, precisely for the reason that you mentioned about what prosecutors, particularly in big cities, can do, because their impact on so many folks, particularly poor people and people of color,
right,
is dramatic.
Right. And I think what you saw in Philadelphia in that election, and it's happened in other cities like Boston and Chicago, are the people who are the most impacted by the system taking the power to change that system. And, you know, when I was trying to piece together how this movement started, I talked a lot to a civil rights leader named Rashad Robinson, who had come out of the Black Lives Matter movement, but also the gay rights movement. And he felt like the gay rights movement had delivered this tangible benefit of marriage equality, and that the Black Lives Matter movement was struggling to have a kind of similar tangible benefit. And so I think that was part of the realization that these DA races in big cities, partly because they were down ballot, they don't have huge turnout. They're sometimes in off years. The primary in a lot of big cities determines the election.
Right.
They actually could be really influenced by communities of color. And I think you've seen that. It's been a really pretty amazing growth of, you know, a sense of local voters really taking back their cities.
Absolutely. I want to touch on something you just mentioned when you use the term marriage equality. And words matter. And you could have framed it as gay marriage, which I don't know what that is. I know what marriage equality
is.
Right, there's marriage.
The same for gay people.
And there's marriage, right.
Yeah.
Language is power. And so the fights that Rashad and I are on the board of Race Forward together, National Racial Justice think tank. And so we are close colleagues. They had successes. Because people could get their heads around equality. It made sense. It was clear. It's kind of blurry in some of these other criminal justice spaces until you clarify it in ways that humanize the victims of this system. And so what are some language lessons we can learn about how we frame the argument so that, because so many of us, I imagine, have challenging conversations with folks who maybe believe in being in tough on crime or have a very parochial view of the criminal justice system and law and order. So what is the language that we should be using for folks in the system and having this conversation?
So I think one thing is to think about nouns and how they define people. And so if you call someone an inmate or a parolee or an offender, you're making that their entire identity rather than one thing they did. And that changes how we view people and is dehumanizing. So that's been, I think, an important insight. And I went back and like scrubbed my book. Thank goodness for the search function to make sure that I was like that I was using nouns deliberately with intentionality and wasn't, you know, accidentally. And then I think, and I'm interested in your thoughts on this, that there's lately, I think, on the part of activists, an effort to use the idea of human caging, which is a really vivid image, as opposed to, you know, prison or incarceration, which is kind of this like bulky, abstract word. I've never really liked that
cages
word.
Cages sends a message.
It really does. And if you talk to people who are in jail or prison, they will tell you, you know, they describe their surroundings in ways that are a pretty good match for the word cage. So I've been really interested to see that arise. I think it's a way of forcing people to reckon with what it's really like to be on the inside.
Well, I really appreciate your intentionality. The words we use, and I find this as a public servant in the state legislature, one of my very first experiences on the House floor was listening to a white supremacist refer to fellow Pennsylvanians as illegals and illegal aliens and illegal alien invasion. And he used the term 14 times in 6 minutes, and I was livid. And I looked to my left and to my right, and people were just listening to him. And I said, "This can't be. This is unacceptable." And so I raised, I stood up and I said, "This is an objectionable. This should be against the House rules." And the Speaker of the House conferred with the parliamentarian and said, "No, this was a neutral term. It's an official term. It's a government term." And then I, as a genealogist and family historian, I think about all the things that were official government terms that we would never use now. I found a U.S. census of my great-great-great-grandfather, and I saw his twin brother was listed as an idiot.
Right. That was a way of talking about mentally disabled.
2010, under the Obama administration, they removed the term retarded.
Right.
Deaf and dumb. Right? These are legal terms. There's a term I use that's still in force, minority. I don't use minority unless I'm talking about white people. I don't want to be compared. I don't say, all the non-males, stand up. No, you shouldn't be compared to some other group. You have your own value, your own intrinsic value.
Right.
And so these words matter. And so when you use dehumanizing language, it makes it easy to legislate, to opine to other folks in ways that are detrimental, not just to them, but to the entire society, because now we've come to a point where we've locked up so many people. Right, we've surpassed all other countries. We have 5 times more people than any other country in terms of the caged population around the globe. And now people from very different ideological bents are saying, this is gonna bankrupt us. This is no way to govern. This is no way to run a society and to address crime. And so we're having some interesting kind of bedfellows.
Yes, which is actually crucial and important,
yes.
Right? That, you know, when I was reporting for my book and I learned that Grover Norquist had written an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal in which he claimed criminal justice reform as a principal accomplishment of fiscal conservatives, I thought, like, okay, we're like onto something here. Last summer, I was interviewing Mark Holden, who works for the Koch brothers and is kind of their point man on criminal justice, and it was not that different from talking to people on the left about this issue. You know, he's coming at it from a different vantage point that has more to do with return on investment. You know, why do we have a system where so many Right. people are cycling back into jail and prison? That's a waste of money. But there's also this sort of deep belief among a lot of conservatives, especially evangelicals, about second chances.
Right.
So I think that's actually something that has wide appeal. And when you look at polls about, you know, will you support a candidate who is committed to reducing incarceration, that's now polling at 60% across the country. And so there's a way in which, to go back to marriage equality, I think that it's changing really quickly, that there's a kind of nonsensical aspect to our way over-incarcerated kind of ballooned system that people get, and it's now on the politicians to kind of catch up, which sounds like the Pennsylvania legislature has some catching up to do.
We got a long way to go. I'm doing what I can tell you that. But just as an example of that, I decided I was going to reintroduce my bill to repeal the death penalty. And my co-prime, thank you. The person who's going to be the co-prime sponsor of my bill is one of the most conservative members of the Republican caucus.
And what's his or her reason for doing this?
Number one is faith. His faith does not believe that it is fair or just. And he also grew up very poor. And he believes the system double victimizes poor people. And he said, it's just not right, it's just not fair. And I just wanted to see if he would support my bill. And he wants to be the co-prime. He wants to be out there front and center. I was shocked.
Yeah,
so there's a real
really
opportunity. What I've seen in Harrisburg is the left and the right, it's not like this, it's like this, right? So you have far left and far right, they don't trust government. They're both like this.
Right.
So it's not like that. So there are certain opportunities that we really have to actively embrace. And one of those opportunities right now is to let these folks speak. I know they have a ton of questions for you. I could talk to you for hours more, but I want to give it up to the people. are you ready to get going?
Yeah.
All right, so what I'm going to ask you to do is, well, let's give you a round of applause. You are wonderful,
thank
Emily.
You. Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Emily Bazelon.
Thank you.
This is very exciting. All right, so it's your opportunity. I'm going to ask you to raise your hand.
I'm Sianna. Emily, thanks for your wonderful book. I have a question. If you could talk a little bit about substance and process. So how is it kind of like the substance of ideology or the substance of morality or the substance of ethics? How does that match up with prosecutors' process about how they make decisions, particularly those interested in reform?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think there's been more and more attention to what people in the system call procedural justice. Like, what is it like to go through the steps of the system? Even if your outcome is your case is dismissed, or if you're a victim, you feel satisfied, how do you feel along the way? And those are crucial parts of the system. You know, one of the things I do as a reporter is just like go back over and over again and then try to let my readers, or for this podcast I'm working on that goes with my book, my listeners, experience what it's like to be there all the time. Because, you know, that's what I get to do. And people's experience of every step along the way while it's happening to them matters a lot. So things like delay or the, you know, what to me is like these sort of small but telling humiliations of having to wait all day in court, or you have to go see your bail agent and he or she, he really in my experience, he is in a position of authority to kind of lord his power over you and just make you feel really low and deflated because he can. I think those parts of the system are important to address. And, you know, one thing about the current state of affairs is that victims, when you ask them, express real sense of disappointment and betrayal all the time. So if we can improve procedural justice, that's also important for them too. I mean, they're really important to consider in this equation.
In the incarceration crisis that you've described, what is the role, if any, of for-profit prisons? How widespread is it, and how can it be combated?
That's a great question. So for-profit prisons particularly, are about 7% of the total incarcerated population. So it's not a huge phenomenon, but I think it looms large for us because we hear stories of abuses. There's a really good book by Shane Bowers, a Mother Jones reporter, where he actually went inside as a prison guard to a corporate-run prison. You know, they tend to be places they're trying to make money. That is problematic given how vulnerable people who go to prison are, how much they are at the mercy of the system. And then the other thing that I think is really important if you're going to start following the money is to think about private probation companies, the bail system, which is, we were just talking about that. That is those bonds are underwritten by giant multinational corporations. They're making $2 billion a year. That's the best estimate in the United States. So there are a number of ways in which money and people's profit motives infect how we deliver justice, how we treat people, and it does kind of saturate the system. And I think a lot of people are impacted by it, feel like their lives are being kind of sold, and that we don't really acknowledge that enough.
And state prisons in Pennsylvania, none of them are privately run.
Right,
just so
you guys don't have that problem here.
Yes.
Hi there. So proud of you, Emily.
Thank you.
One thing that occurs to me, we've talked a lot about the prosecutors, but the other half of this are the public defenders. Is there any kind of movement afoot to strengthen the job that they do for the victims?
Yeah, I mean, I think one important proposal is the idea of having the federal government fund public defense. There's a law professor at Fordham named John Pfaff who's he's a math person, like really good at quantitative work, and he has the idea that $2 billion a year could really fund defense for poor people across the country in a way that would eliminate the real disparities of what kind of counsel you get depending on where you live, how committed your city or county is for paying for it. Our current system often, the budgets are actually tied together, and so sometimes you see the district attorney trying to take a bigger slice of the pie and leave even less money for defense for poor people. It really differs just depending where you are, in a way that creates enormous regional disparity.
And do you know how much money the state of Pennsylvania gives to defenders associations in Pennsylvania?
I don't know, but maybe you know.
Zero?
Wow. So where does that money come from? It's all counties or?
Elsewhere.
Elsewhere, okay.
And that's deeply problematic because that's the anomaly nationwide. They normally get something. We get nothing.
Right. And so then it's up to every locality and you can have tremendous differences. Yeah.
I'm Dan Stevenson. I'm chief of the homicide unit in Defender's Office. And I have a question.
Okay, all right.
You are the right person for the next question.
You got skin in the game.
Well, I do. Please. I have questions for each of you, actually.
Okay.
Ms. Bazelon, have you, in your journey around the country, have you noticed the pushback that Mr. Krasner is receiving from the bench by the forces of reaction and racism, actually? Now, this was to be expected from all of the district attorneys that he fired, but I did not expect this from the bench. And Mr. Robb, you mentioned that life in Pennsylvania means just that. It is life. Now, I know there's a bill somewhere bottled up in committee that seeks to impose parole eligibility on life after a certain amount of years. Is there any hope that that will ever see the light of day?
You want to go first? You want me to go first?
So, I don't want you to think what I'm saying is optimistic because I'm rather allergic to optimism. But eventually, when I started in 2016, I was elected the same night as what's-his-name. I joined this.
And if, you know, that, like, could have made you feel better right there.
Yeah, right.
Silver linings are important.
Yes. My kids were not thinking about my victory that night. They were like,
huh.
I joined the smallest minority in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives in 60 years. Over the course of 2 years, you all know what happened. There's a great movement, and now I'm a Democrat. We're 9 seats away from taking back the majority. All right, so, and I don't mean to be super partisan here, and I want to get to other questions, but I want to put this in
very neutral statement.
In context, raise your hand if you live in Philly or the Philly area. Okay.
All right.
So in my world, when I go to work in Harrisburg, I'm surrounded by folks who many have never been to a big city. And so to them, Philly is where all the bad people live, where all the bad things, where all their hardworking tax dollars are spent, when in fact, for every dollar we give as Philadelphians, we get back like 73 cents. I say that to say that not all Democrats are created equal, and you go outside of metro areas and you find some very conservative Democrats. So even if we take back the majority in 2020 or 2022, there's not going to be unanimity necessarily. And so I'm on the Judiciary Committee. The profile of Democrats on the Judiciary Committee is far more progressive than it has been previously. We have a liberal minority chair for the Judiciary Committee, but all the power rests in the majority party. The majority chair of the Judiciary Committee decides what bills he wants, and it's a he, and all the Democrats, by the way, are men for all standing committees, all men. He decides what bills are worthy of a public hearing or an up or down vote. So the way that that's going to happen is if we organize, and we organize across the ideological spectrum, particularly because we now see that there are folks who are very conservative who are opposed to a lot of these things that promote mass incarceration. So I don't think it's going to happen in this term, but I think we will be able to make serious progress within 4 years. And I can stand on my head for 4 years if I have to. So I'm in it, and I think we're on the right side of history here. I think the momentum is going in the right way.
So Larry Krasner, your DA, is facing significant pushback from the bench. He is a fighter. He's someone who is not going to back down when he's challenged. I should say, disclosure, my sister Dana works for Larry Krasner, so I have that window into the office. And I think, you know, some of the judges in Philadelphia don't want to be told that there's a new way to do things. They're used to having the DA go along with all kinds of long sentences, long terms of parole and probation. And the idea that someone's going to do it differently is a real challenge to them. People don't like to be told that they were doing their jobs wrong. I have seen this in a couple other places. So in Houston, there was a little bit different story, but there was a big lawsuit a couple years ago suing their entire misdemeanor bail system. They were doing these sort of instant hearings within like 30 seconds or 2 minutes. People were having bail set with really almost no due process. A group called the Civil Rights Corps sued a federal judge, found the whole system unconstitutional. And then there was a huge fight over what was going to come next. The new DA, whose name is Kim Ogg, came in on the side of reform, but the 14 misdemeanor count elected county judges were all opposed to reform. They spent $6 million of public funds appealing this ruling and really tried to sabotage it in all kinds of nefarious ways that caused the rate of people not coming back to court to go to skyrocket, which like discredits the whole idea of trying to provide an alternative to bail. It was a big mess. And you know what? Last November, the voters in Houston threw out every single one of those 14 misdemeanors, all of them, they're all gone. So that's a story, I think, about the next phase of the criminal justice reform movement, which are that judicial elections are going to become more of a part of it.
Hi there. I've been a criminal defense attorney in Boston for the last 21 years, and we just elected a new reform-minded DA, Rachel Rollins. And my question has to do with what did you find with the relationship between the police and the prosecutor's office? Like in Boston, she has this 15 decline to prosecute charges just across the board, possession, disorderly conduct, resisting arrest, and there's a Twitter feed, Court Watch Mass, and there's people that are sitting in courtrooms reporting on pushback from judges and prosecutors. You know, the presumption is there's going to be no bail on many, unless there's like a supervisor that has said, and there's, a dangerousness finding. But the police, there's been an uptick now in charging assault and battery on a police officer, so you don't have that ability to decline to prosecute. And so I was curious, you have all this discretion, right, with the prosecutors, but you've got this, and in Boston, they're kind of crazy about, like, the BPD is not happy.
Right, yeah. No, there have been some law enforcement leaders who've tried to sue Rollins for her declaration that she wouldn't charge certain low-level crimes. And, police departments have pushed back here. It's a feature of a number of these cities. I was actually reading about this in Dallas today. The DA there had said that he wasn't going to prosecute theft below $750, and the police called on him to resign. But then it turned out that they actually themselves are not arresting people for low-level theft because they don't have the resources to bring these arrests.
It's like a reflex.
Yeah, well, it's a blame shifting. I think that part of what's going on are that police are seeing, if the district attorney is going to make this argument that, we think is not a law pro tough on crime argument, even if we're kind of going along with it quietly, we want to be seen as standing up for these previous policies. And now we can just shift the blame onto the DA. It's going to be a really complicated dynamic. But I think what's really important is that some of these prosecutors, the prosecutor in Dallas, John Crusoe, he's not backing down. And if prosecutors can explode the myth that they have to always be allied with law enforcement, that's going to scramble the politics of this. So to a certain degree, I think some of these questions are about the next election. Can folks get reelected despite or because having challenged the police?
So if I can move the topic a little bit to ask about recidivism. That is to ask, you mentioned long tails of parole and probation and the difficulty that poses. Can you talk about what hope you see for better systems, what might work to improve reentry, what prosecutors might do to help plan for that?
Yeah, sure. So, we are currently, as a society, kind of generally setting these very long tails of punishment where people have supervised release, often with an average of 20 conditions for five years. It's a really long time. One of the people in my book and in my podcast was had a 9 o'clock curfew for 5 years. Like, that's just, I don't, you have to, like, how do you function as a grown-up? I am still confused about that. And then you have this problem of these technical violations. You blow your curfew, you're not home for an unannounced home visit, and then you're back in jail. This is such a missed opportunity, right? Like, imagine a world for a moment where people have 1 year, maybe 2 or 3 years at the most of supervised release. There's some research after a year, it's kind of pointless. And during that year, parole officers who would have smaller caseloads would be able to be more like social workers and helping people get restarted, connecting them to services. There's a little bit of that right now, and I sometimes hear about it actually more in small towns where parole officers are like looking out for their the people they're serving. But most of them are just processing cases. They have so many people, they don't really have the capacity to play that kind of role, and it just seems like you could reinvent and reimagine parole and probation to be something that helped people as opposed to just like got them into more trouble.
Right, because practically speaking, in Pennsylvania, the size of those folks who are supervised in parole or probation is the same size as our second largest city.
Yeah, you guys have a crazy percentage.
300,000 people are under state supervision, essentially.
Right.
How do you do that?
Right.
We don't.
Right. Can I say one more thing
Absolutely.
About this? Sorry. One of the stories in my book is about a diversion program for gun offenders in New York that is social work. The people doing it are social workers who work out of the DA's office. Very unusual model. I mean, I don't know what I think about it being in the DA's office, but watching the social workers work with these young people who'd had guns was impressive. Like, they were really trying to help people make their lives better, improve the circumstances of their lives in a way that would lead them to the decision not to have a gun anymore. So watching that for a couple of years made that feel possible to me.
Hi, my name is Elle Cox. I'm from Lafayette College. And my question is kind of a conceptual question. When we're looking at the ways in which, you know, deviant acts are kind of labeled, and we're looking at how they're thought about in society, and we're also looking at, like, the school-to-prison pipeline and the way that police officers can have quota systems and all these things, and it's just so structurally just kind of messed up at the root. How and in what way can we combat that and go all the way to the beginning and say, like, how do we change the way that we think about it to really start to do any sort of change?
That's a giant question, but a good question.
You have 20 seconds.
Well, so I think part of this just starts with how we define safety and what we think makes people safe. And we tend to answer those questions with law enforcement answers, right? Like, if crime goes up, we look at the cops, we look at the court system, at DA's offices. We don't usually say, like, wait, how are our schools functioning? Do we have enough mental health services or just healthcare in general in the community? Oh, thank you. There is lots of research suggesting that the health of a community in this way that really improves people's lives matters a tremendous amount for public safety. And so that's like a conceptual narrative shift that everybody can be a part of really taking root, I think.
My response is a lot more terse. We need to hold public servants accountable. I felt so strongly about that I became one. And if we see folks not doing their job, we need to shut down the institution. We need to shut it down. We need to demand that these issues are addressed substantively and in good faith. Because when people show up, those of us who have 65,000 or more bosses, we tend to pay attention. And so if it's a priority to all of you, and you make it known to those of us who are creating, amending, or repealing state law, we will respond. And there's I call that co-governance. So it's not just that you get the right person in office and you say, okay, do your thing. You got to keep us accountable. You have to work with us along the way. And part of that is causing some trouble. Without that trouble, all the best social justice movements are born out of that. That keeps us honest, and we have to do that nonstop.
As you know, I'm very interested in professional ethics.
That's true. I do know that.
And so I'd like to take you back to the discussion you had about the person who failed to disclose the DNA.
Yes, that does not seem like an ethical practice.
And so the specific question is, what happened to that guy? The more general question is, these people are, with the Brady violation of not telling the information that is against the prosecution, allows people to be in jail for 10, 20, 30 years. Tell us about what happens to the prosecutors.
The reason starts actually with the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court made prosecutors absolutely immune from lawsuits. That was pretty Freudian slip of the tongue. Immune from lawsuits in the 70s. And that absolute immunity, like the police have something else called qualified immunity, which is like pretty good, but absolute immunity, like if you do something in the course of your job, you cannot be sued personally. And then later the court made it very hard to sue the office or a municipality. And at the time the court said, don't worry, because if a prosecutor commits a grave constitutional violation, someone will come along and prosecute that prosecutor. So that doesn't happen. I found, and I think this is wasn't just me, that there have been two prosecutors, like in modern times, who have gone to jail for a couple of days. That's just not a thing. And then the other kind of reassurance the Supreme Court offered was that the legal profession would police prosecutors. And that has also not been a successful avenue.
No?
No. Huh. And I tell a story about this in my book. I watched what was called an ethics trial involving an accusation that a prosecutor had withheld exonerating evidence at trial. And, I mean, you know, I won't give away the whole story, but it was not encouraging. I think it's really hard for lawyers to sit in judgment of other lawyers. And it did not feel, it was like the, you know, you watch a defendant, there's this assumption that this person has done something wrong and is other and different and lesser. It was like the opposite. It was like bending over backward to give the prosecutor the benefit of the doubt.
Hmm. Emily, leave us on a high note. I think a lot of us need some inspiration here. What can we look toward? What can we embrace that gives us a sense of hope and direction? And is that a fair question? Give us something good here. What can we work with?
So I actually feel hopeful right now. Look, we have such a long way to go. I mean, if I had a graph, the country is just starting to have fewer people in jail or prison, but if we continue just at our current rate of decline, it will take 75 years to get to half. So that's just not good enough. That was not hopeful. But here's the hopeful part. Cities like Philadelphia have the chance to become models for the country. I mean, I grew up here. I love the city. It's been moving to see Philadelphia get so much attention in the national spotlight for trying new things. It's going to be hard, and not all of it's going to work. And like every change or a big effort in government, it's going to be a big, heavy lift. But cities, because of the power of local voters, can really demonstrate that it's possible to end these practices that have caused so much harm and have safe and healthy communities. And I think then your job will hopefully be easier of convincing your colleagues
in the
legislature.
Yes.
So as someone who loves cities, that part of it seems really resonant to me, and it's great to be here with all of you.
Wonderful.
Thank you for coming.
Emily Bazelon, thank you so much for sharing your evening with us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.